Welcome to Fanboy News Network, your guide to geek culture. I'm Jeff Harris.
And I'm Dan Christensen.
And so welcome back.
Yes, thanks. Good
to
be back.
You know, last episode, you were off celebrating. What birthday was it for your mom?
It was my mother and my wife's 105th birthday. I will leave it as an exercise to the reader to do the math.
There you go. That's a good policy. Jen Lovely from Don't Read the Latin and I, our birthdays are only 2 days apart.
Yes.
You know, you were at our birthday party last year. And I think we calculated that collectively it would be our 92nd.
Yes.
Birthday or 92 years of awesome.
92 years of awesome
is what
by all means.
She wants to call it this year. Anyway, so yeah, last week we did the special All Santo episode with Rich Redman. And this week, so it's October. I always like to do a horror theme month during October, but there's been so much geek news. I feel that if we don't touch on our regular stuff this week, we're going to fall way behind.
Definitely.
But I would like to start out with talking about some horror stuff.
I will tap out and let you do that because I know nothing about the subject.
So, the first thing is I'm always looking for good scripted podcasts. You know, that was always the thing. What's the term? Do we call it radio plays? Well, that doesn't seem right. But
audio drama.
Audio drama, a lot of people use. But I recently found that the TV Tropes page will refer to them as scripted podcasts.
Okay.
And I think that's a really, it's an easy term because it kind of makes sense. It's a podcast, but it's been scripted. And Welcome to Night Vale is currently the king.
Of course.
You know, everyone, and I love Welcome to Night Vale. And it certainly can be horror, but it covers a lot of genres. It can do comedy, horror, often in the same episode. It can be very dramatic. It's got a lot of its fans are there for the romance. But I was looking for other scripted podcasts since I'm working on one myself. And I feel that to make a good one, I have to listen to others to see, you know, what are they doing? What does it sound like? What can I glean from them?
Of course, you always, it's always best, no matter what you're doing, for whatever creativity is, immerse yourself in that creativity and see what other people are doing.
And this actually came from Will Wheaton's Tumblr. But he pointed to a podcast called The Black Tapes Podcast.
Okay.
And I'm really glad he did. I've started listening to it. I'm not quite halfway through the series. It's local. I think that it's primarily out of Vancouver. But BC.
I was going to say, for those of us not in the immediate vicinity, I'm assuming you're meaning the only Vancouver worth visiting, a.k.a. British Columbia, as opposed to the Couve.
I think so because a lot of it is also recorded in Seattle.
Okay.
And it's set in Seattle and it's closer to Vancouver, BC from Seattle than it is down in the southern part of the state. So the show is set in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. And the premise is that it's kind of a riff off of Serial, if you ever heard of that podcast.
Well, I'd heard that it was Serial mixed with X-Files.
That's a fair assessment. Like Serial, it's purported as a spinoff. Whereas Serial was a spinoff of This American Life and following a single story through each season, this is a spinoff of Pacific Northwest Stories, which is claimed in-universe to be a national radio show.
Okay.
And the premise is that the producer who's doing the spinoff wanted to do a show exploring people through their profession, learning about people who have unique jobs, and the first thing they were going to go after was paranormal investigators. Okay. In the course of researching and interviewing people and getting ready for this, a single name kept coming up, Dr. Richard Strand. And in interviewing him, he's a debunker. He's based largely on James Randi.
Okay, yeah.
And including having an institute with a prize for people who could prove that something is supernatural, and he investigates from a skeptic point of view. So she interviews him, and she learns that he has a whole bunch of files that he basically keeps in old black VCR cases, even though he's got like thumb drives and pictures of modern media, but he keeps them in VCR cases because I guess it's an easy way for him to separate. And white
might as well, they're not being used for anything else this season.
Yeah, and white ones, which are the majority, are the cases he solved. But he's got a row of ones that are in black that are the ones he didn't They didn't prove it was supernatural, but he couldn't explain everything in it. And so what the premise is from the first episode, she changes the focus of the show and convinces Strand to let her explore his unresolved cases. And a little bit of serendipity, Strand gets a grant to work at the University of Washington for like a year, doing an investigation with him, which means he's suddenly in her backyard, and they just start working in his off time, going over his old cases. And it's interesting because, one, it's well produced. The people making it really know what they're doing. They again, since they're trying to base it a lot off of Serial, they are going for the really strong production values. I mean, these are people who are supposed to be professionals,
right,
in the trade. So bad audio quality would kill the show.
Of course.
But they also go out of their way to not even hint that it's fiction. The actors, I think the lead actress might be using her real name.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure, because they only showed an obscured picture of him on their website, that the actor playing Richard Strand is not using his real name. But they're not saying who the actors are.
Okay.
And the two writers of the series are listed in the credits as the executive producers.
So it's Serial, X-Files, with a little bit of Blair Witch thrown in for good measure.
Yeah. Okay. And it maintains the skepticism. It presents these very likely supernatural scenarios, but you always have Strand poking holes in their own theories. actually, there was a term I did not know, and I hope I'm going to say it right. Apophenia. Yeah, I think it's great. Apophenia. It's the human tendency to assign meaning to something random.
Yes.
So why did this happen? Well, there had to be a reason. It couldn't just be random occurrence. And that apophenia is a leading cause for people to assume things are supernatural, because there's no better, because they can't find an explanation that satisfies them.
Yeah, apophenia and pareidolia are the two great downfalls, because apophenia is saying there must be a reason for this, and pareidolia is trying to see an image where there isn't one.
Yeah. So, but in the investigations of their stories, which they don't always solve, I mean, these are unsolved for a reason, there are times the show gets genuinely creepy.
Good.
They make up towns in Washington. They do things where, because it's set in Seattle, we as Seattle natives can very clearly tell, oh, this is fiction. But they do it in a way that somebody who was listening in, say, Detroit wouldn't be able to immediately poke holes in it and could go, oh, really?
Much like Take Your Pick. There's the Twilight things, and the Sleepless in Seattle is always my favorite. And,
oh, yeah. Well, in this case, like they have a rock band in one of the episodes, and it's one of those rock bands that, you know, if you lived in Seattle in the 80s, you would have known of this band, Duffy Bishop and the Rhythm Dogs. But outside of Seattle, you'd never heard of them. You moved after they broke up, so exactly. You've never heard of them. Mm-hmm. But in Seattle, they were really well known. They did commercials on Cairo. So they have a band in the show called Hastur Rising. And they state, well, if you live in Seattle, you've heard of them. So,
yeah.
You know, but beyond that, even knowing going in that this is a fictional account, it's very good.
Good.
And it's one of those things that has me listening going, okay, so what am I gleaning out of this? Well, one thing, you know, make sure the actors sound natural. So yeah, it's one I could certainly recommend. I'm still obviously looking into other scripted podcasts. Probably in the next month, I'm going to do a written review of the science fiction one I listened to, EOS 10. Also because, you know, I've kind of have correspondence going on with the creator of that, and I'd like to give him a boost. Other than that, I think for horror recently, well, I've been watching my normal Friday night group, and we've been on a kick as it's gotten closer to Halloween of watching movies from when we were teenagers, basically. So
the 80s.
Yeah, not necessarily straight horror, mm-hmm. but things that are in the horror genre, but had cultural meaning to us.
Well, I was going to say, you did Ghostbusters last week.
Yeah, last week was Ghostbusters. Before that was They Live. Mm-hmm. And prior to that was Creepshow. So the one thing all of them have in common is a strong line of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Creepshow, at least when I saw it in high school, there were some genuinely scary moments.
Oh, yeah.
Now, and some of it is aged well. Mm-hmm. And then They Live. They Live is a movie that's aged incredibly well. And is, in particular, the underlying message of inequality, of the economic inequality, is probably more relevant now than when it came out.
Oh, it came out in Reagan era, so I mean...
But it's either that or the cycle's come to a point where it's relevant again. We were sitting there thinking, wow, this still holds up. And as a movie, it still holds up because special effects use in the movie was very subtle. Mm-hmm. And because of the conceit, it was always done in black and white, which covers a ton of visual effects sins.
I was going to say, it forgives a multitude of sins. So, but the other thing with They Live is it's kind of stayed in the cultural mindset, because I mean, there's that whole line of obey clothes that are out,
yeah,
which totally plays with the conceit.
I think the other thing that's interesting is a lot of people remember it for the quippy lines, you know, I'm here to chew bubblegum and kick ass, which doesn't happen until 40 minutes into the movie. Really, the character Piper plays is very sincere through the first part of the movie. It's only as he starts getting more and more exposed to the craziness going on around him that he himself starts losing it a little bit and starts becoming more of the one-liner guy, almost as a defense mechanism to what he's seeing.
But you can't hold it against for how long it was, because, I mean, Hasta la vista, baby, is one of the last lines, and I'll be back, and are famous ones from the very last of the shows. So
yeah. So anyway, it's They Live, I think, is one that's, I would love to see a re-release on that one. You know, maybe it does a midnight screenings around Halloween. It's just, it's relevant. And I know there was people who have already done posters of politicians all the time.
Of course.
As that. It's like you said, it's a visual language. And I think it's one of the last Carpenter films before he just stopped caring.
That's a nice way of putting it. Well, okay.
The thing we couldn't remember, and I didn't look it up, is around They Live was also around the same time as Prince of Darkness came out.
Okay.
And those are the last two movies. I want to say, because of memory, I think it was Prince of Darkness and then They Live. Whichever those two was the second to come out was the last time I think Carpenter really cared. I think after that it was just like, you know what? I'm just collecting paychecks now. But yeah, that's been the horror I've been looking at lately. Other than, you know, YouTube has become an amazing resource for the amateur filmmaker.
Okay, in what way?
Well, because you have people thinking, get their stuff out. And you're the one that always says the cream will rise.
Yes.
And there is some excellent short horror on YouTube. And I would think if you're looking for some good horror to look at, I would recommend, I believe it's called Cargo, about a father in a zombie apocalypse. He's been bitten and he has an infant. And he's trying to set up that for the child to survive after he turns. So before he turns, he's setting it up so that he can try and get his daughter to safety, even if he turns before he can finish getting her there. It's done cleverly, but there's a lot of tension because, of course, once you've got a baby involved,
yeah,
you're going to have tension. Another great one is, has sort of become a classic because it got gift filed a lot, was called Bedfellows.
Okay.
And I would also really recommend, okay, so They Live was the one that came out second. Okay, yeah, for the last time I think he cared. What came out after?
Memoirs of an Invisible Man, Village of the Damned, Escape from L.A.
Okay, Escape from L.A. was the moment he just gave up all hope.
Yeah.
Village of the Damned was an okay movie, but it was a remake.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, so I was saying good shorts to watch. There was a series that didn't get finished, was called Camera Obscura. Was very good. And all right, it's not quite horror, but the same guy who's done a lot of these horror shorts did one called Meat. It's just called Meat. And it's worth watching. It's actually kind of funny and kind of scary. So, because you're always hearing these things about, you know, things you don't want to watch if you want to sleep that night. You get a lot of Slender Man mythos on YouTube.
Never ceases to amaze me. Something that, is, they mean, they do everything but scream it from the rooftops that this is made up, and people still fall for it.
Well,
and people
still... Yeah, Slender Man's made up, but the guy who created him put a lot of work into picking bits and pieces of different things that creeped him out and blending them very well. And I think because he did it in a group source kind of way to create different versions of the story, discrepancies, because if that actually helps propagate it, because that way you have different interpretations. I still think there's some argument about what's the best. Marble Hornet is very good, but I still think the best to touch on the Slenderman mythos online is Everyman Hybrid.
Okay.
So Everyman Hybrid's one of those tricky ones to find out, though, because since they're presenting it as it's real, you got to go online to find the listing, because it's the story is told across two different YouTube accounts and a Twitter account.
You know, and this is where I kind of hang it up, because I actually, it's funny, as a tie-in to other aspects of geekdom, I just finished Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice. And one of the primary themes in that is unreliability of memory and unreliability of the narrator.
Right.
And to have to, I mean, that was hard enough, and it was in a book. It was bound in pages. And I still struggled with it. To have to struggle through two different YouTube channels and a Twitter channel, it's just like the whole line between what is unreliability of the narrator and made up and real, and it's just, I'm waiting for the cream to rise. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well, I felt those were good versions of that story.
And they were?
Everyman Hybrid's the really good one.
Okay.
But Marble Hornets is worth checking out too. It's pretty good too. I just think Everyman Hybrid's slightly better.
Okay.
So anyway, the other thing we had talked about was, well, we can't just do horror because so much has happened recently.
Oh my, yes.
And so let's turn our eyes to the convention scene.
Okay.
And in this last weekend, we had locally Geek Girl Con.
Yay.
And then on the bigger stage in New York City was New York City Comic Con.
Oh, by the way, yeah.
Yeah. And so a lot of different things came out from these.
Yeah.
Now, I went to Geek Girl Con.
Mm-hmm.
And Geek Girl Con, for those that don't know, is kind of what it says on the tin. It's a two-day convention held at the Washington Convention Center that has a focus on women in fandom, women created properties, a little bit of feminist theory, and also is, in my opinion, one of the most inviting shows to younger fans.
Well, yeah, because they not only do they have the kids track, but they've got the whole science thing going on. And yeah, it is definitely more kid and family oriented in addition to being women focused.
Yeah. I went last year, and one of the things I was telling over the last year, Jennifer Lovely from Don't Read the Latin, is how much I enjoyed that aspect. And because her daughter is very into science at six.
And she's only six?
Yeah, she's only six. Six and a half at this point.
Still.
That I would really wanted to take her, even if it was just letting Jen let me take her. But Jen did end up coming, and Jen's new boyfriend. And Jen's boyfriend and her daughter cosplayed as Grunkle Stan and Mabel from Gravity Falls, including she was carrying a little Waddles, which is Mabel's pet pig.
Okay.
For those of you not familiar with Gravity Falls. And people loved it because there were people dressed up as Mabel's brother. I don't know if I saw another Mabel. I certainly didn't see a Grunkle Stan, who is probably more visually distinct than... I mean, you could easily mistake Mabel for just a little girl.
Right.
But the character of Grunkle Stan has some... has a fez with a weird symbol on it. And it was very easy to pick out that that's what he was. And so it was a successful cosplay for... We were stopped all the time for pictures. But they have this, again, this great science track.
Yes.
And my goddaughter was absolutely excited. She, at one point, we had to go do something else, and she kept going, well, when do we go back and do more science? I want to do more science. And, you know, she got to do more science. And the people they had there were great. I mean, they had set things up. They had safety things. These were very kid-safe science experiments.
Good.
I was paying attention to what a couple of them were in case I wanted to recreate them later, because we tend to do science games at parties when there's a lot of kids.
Right.
At one point, they essentially made comets, or they took material to make little homemade comets, and there was making homemade gack and doing...
Beg pardon?
Gack or slime.
Okay.
At one point, there was taking rose water and seeing how it reacted with acidity.
Interesting.
Just stuff like that. And she was just like, this is great. And we learned of these stickers. I think it's, what is it? It's Chibitronics, I think. They are circuit stickers you can put on paper.
Okay.
And create like light up paper.
Interesting.
Well, by putting the stickers on the other side. And it was like, well, that's something we're going to be checking out.
Well, and anything that's going to spark the imagination for kids to get more involved in STEM, because that is so needed this season.
And the DU, and the Science Center is set up as a STEM. I mean, it has STEM in the name. And I was talking to one of the presenters about how I got my goddaughter interested in science, and somebody overheard the person running the whole thing. And while she was doing one of the things, we talked. She was like, so... You know, she was just interested in, so you've got her interest in science. Yeah, we would do science games at her parties. And she's gotten to the point that she asks me to do science. And, you know, keeping her mind open to the idea that science is fun and science is something she can do.
Yes.
So I got some suggestions of some new things to get her, because that's my job, is to teach her science.
Okay, then.
Or to teach her to love science. I will let smarter people than I actually teach her science. So, anyway, Geek Girl Con, well done. There was a lot of good cosplay. Zoe Quinn and Anita Skarzizian were guests this year, so there were some really interesting panels.
I'm sure. I said it before, and I'll say it again. If I had known that they were going to be there, I would have shown up, because I've always wanted to see them live, and preferably, you know, without bomb threats.
You know, I think within the last week, all the passes sold out.
Yeah?
So it's a smaller show. I mean, it doesn't use the entire convention center. But, you know, there, again, some good stuff there. Mm-hmm. Now, at New York City Comic Con, the interesting things that came there... So it's one of the big shows. It's number two, I believe.
Yeah, it's number two behind San Diego.
And it naturally sells out.
Oh, yeah.
But one of the things that was reported this year was that the vendors made more money this year than in years past. And people were trying to figure out, well, why? Why was it such a good year for vendors? Now, the first thing is, well, you know, the economy is recovering.
Yes.
Number one. But the other thing that people pointed out that were really looking at it was there was a reduction in the number of weekend passes available and an increase in the number of day passes.
Okay.
And so there were more day passes sold, and... that people who are only, you know, being more strategic. Well, I'm just going to go for these days because the people I want to see are on these days. And that people who would, you know, let's say that somebody says, I can set aside $300 for spending money at a convention. And if you're going to be there for 4 days, you know, part of that spending money is going to go to food, which will take away from what can go to vendors, and you're going to hold on to more, spread it out. Whereas people who are going for 1 day, you know,
boom.
Yeah, that little bit more of that budget can go to getting cool things.
Yeah, less on food, less on parking, more on fun stuff.
Yeah. So that, and you know, from the vendor perspective, great. It made it a very profitable show for them. And so I guess the question becomes, is this a good model? Is this a good model for viability for conventions, especially ones that sell out?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that people will be getting the individuals, or that they were actually had those numbers, because Reed Pop, who owns New York and who now owns Emerald City, they normally keep those numbers pretty close to the vest as far as how many actual tickets that they have for each of the different categories.
Well, all right. I should point out that this is mostly a theory.
Okay.
Based on observation.
Okay.
Well, again, you look at Emerald City. The 3 and 4 day passes, the 4 day pass is sold out within an hour.
Yep.
The 3 day pass is sold out within 24 hours.
Yep.
But here we are, what, about a month after?
Not even that. It's only been a couple weeks.
No, it was because it was on the 15th.
Okay.
I remember having that marked down. So it's been about a month
yeah.
since they went on sale. And all 4 days still have passes available.
Yeah.
If you want to go to Emerald City, you still can. So that does lend credence again to the idea that there's might be more single day passes available than full weekend passes.
Yeah. And and interestingly, you could actually get 4 single day passes and go all 4 days.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But there are people that are being strategic. A lot of people are, I expect Saturday and Sunday will sell out first.
Oh yeah.
Saturday,
Nathan Fillion.
Well, I was going to say Saturday is always the most popular day.
Yeah.
Plus Saturday and Sunday, Nathan Fillion mm-hmm. is going to be there. So a lot of people, he's going to be their get for photos and autographs.
Oh yes.
Of course, we don't know who's going to fill out the rest of the weekend. We know a few. Daniel Panabaker and Robbie Amell from Flash.
Yep.
And I think they're going to be there 3 days. I think they're Friday through Sunday. But they haven't gotten a lot of other big media names signed up yet.
But they have been pulling in some comic names for comic convention. Oh, yeah. I figure, you know?
Yeah, they still are very comic focused and... that's always been one of Emerald's strengths. And the concern I've heard from people with the Reed Pop purchase is that they might start drifting away from the keeping to the core comics and become more pan-media. There's not any direct signs that that's happening yet.
True.
So right now they get the benefit of a doubt.
Cool. Speaking of pan-media.
Okay. What have I let myself into?
Pan.
Oh!
That has been panned by the critics and... has been pantsed in the reviews and has been...
keep going.
That's all I can remember besides pandemics.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I wanted Pan to tank. More than I wanted Fantastic Four to bite it, I wanted Pan to bite it.
Oh, you mean Fantorstic?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
And I had a very specific reason initially, and then a secondary reason popped up, but... I'm just so sick of whitewash casting.
Yes.
And, you know, Rooney Mara as Tiger Lily was something I was not going to get past.
It has been a large speed bump for a lot of people, and I agree.
And then to find out that apparently, however they did this, they were able to avoid the British copyrights. So the hospital that Barry willed the rights to... and a major part of their operating budget comes from holding the Peter Pan copyright, they didn't get paid.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, you know what? That upsets me more than the whitewash casting.
Well, but you think about it. This was doubly shooting themselves in the foot, because not only is it bad press, but you think about it. Because another thing that's been in the news since at least the last time you and I sat down was the kid in Texas, Ahmed Mohammed, who got busted for bringing a clock to school.
Yeah.
And the response that came from all over the science and not just science and science fiction, but the geek community kind of rose up and said, no, you do not mess with kids. And Emerald City, even I'm not sure what their deal is now through Reed Pop, but Emerald City was their main beneficiary has been Children's Hospital
yeah.
here in Seattle. So yeah, messing with kids and dealing with pop culture and geek stuff is a bad combination. Yeah.
The Ahmed thing, I think part of it was, all right, we have a child interested in science. And you're essentially discouraging that because you're treating his science as a criminal behavior.
Yep.
And yeah, the community, the geek, the tech head community rose up as one and went, oh no.
Yeah.
He's one of ours. We're going to make sure we keep him on the track of this. He's got offers to visit MIT. That's the thing.
He got an invitation to drive the Mars rover at JPL. I mean, how cool is that?
You know, keep the science interest alive and let not just him. I think the important thing there was not just letting him know mm-hmm. that they were there for him. But by representation, any kid like him, no. There is a community out there for you. And if you need them, they will take care of you and you will have a chance to explore your interests.
Well, because you think about it, so many of the geeks our age, I remember growing up, I was horribly bullied all through elementary school, middle school, and high school. Mm-hmm. And I stuck with it. I got through. And these days, somebody messes with a little kid like that, I will eat their lunch to keep this a PG-13 school.
I got a little of that too. Not as much, mostly because being significantly bigger than most of my fellow students.
True.
The bullying was limited to how far can we push him before he might actually hurt us.
Yeah.
So, but I, from the emotional side, I absolutely understand. And yeah, that's the great thing about this story. And I know a lot of people were trying to, I mean, the other side had weird reactions. Again, it comes down to, you know, a kid with electronics and he was brown and the people freaked out.
To be fair, it's a boy with electronics and he was brown, because there was something that happened about a year earlier of an African-American girl down in, I will leave it at the South, I believe it was Georgia, who was doing a science fair experiment and got written up for doing a bomb and got thrown out of school for a couple of days and this, that, and the other thing. And it's kind of crickets as far as she was concerned. Hmm. But you can look it up on, it's actually now a Snopes thing. You can see the girl that, it was the, what is it, where you make something out of Mountain Dew and I think some sort of chemical cleaner and it will make an, but she was trying to do that for her science fair experiment and she got thrown out of school. But there was no outrage there. But anyway, sorry, tangent.
So, anyway, but back to Pan.
Yes.
So I think looking at Pan, and I read a lot of the reviews, the problem is that Pan had everything that you kind of decry in films now in one small package. But it came down to, it was a perfect example of movie by committee.
Okay.
And I mean, just down the line, they took Peter Pan, who was always a mischievous figure. I mean, he was given the last name Pan for a reason. You know, he was a trickster figure. He was mischievous. At times, he was cruel. And, you know, he wasn't a hero.
Oh, no.
Even though he was the hero of the story. You know, he had darker aspects. Mm-hmm. And so in Pan, it was Pan's origin story. And he went from the mischievous trickster kid, the boy who didn't want to grow up, to Harry Potter light, the chosen savior who will save Neverland. So right there, I mean, you're doing the stupid generic origin story that we've seen a million times and we're tired of. There's a bit in the movie where they have the kids are working in the kidnapped kids are working in a mine. And in the original script, they were supposed to be singing a sea shanty, but they just couldn't get the kids to get into the feeling of a sea shanty. So they end up singing Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Oh, my God.
So they had to drop in a line and a thing in it where they weren't pulling, they were pulling kids through time. And that all got added just because they couldn't get the kids to buckle down and sing a sea shanty.
Which are usually pretty fun, but so Knight's Tale,
a little, but badly done, and having black, and the villain wasn't Captain Hook; it was Blackbeard,
okay,
played by Hugh Jackman, because Captain Hook was playing the role of Han Solo to Peter Pan's Luke Skywalker.
All right,
with Tiger Lily as Princess Leia.
Right.
Complete with a romance with Hook.
And not a mistaken romance with... I'm sorry.
No. But, yeah, you start seeing where all these... And, like, the last 5 minutes, they're jokes like, you know, well, I hope we never turn on each other, Peter.
Yeah, okay.
You know, stupid... I mean, it's just, you know, all these awful things, but it comes down to, you know, it was a weak script, overblown effects... bad casting decisions, and Warner Brothers wonders why they've had, you know, this movie tank, which Warner Brothers is having a terrible year. Basically, any studio that's not Disney or Sony is having a very bad year because, and they're like, well, why are we having such a bad box office? Well, maybe it's because you're putting out bad movies.
I was going to say.
Now, I wanted to see Man from U.N.C.L.E. and it looked good, but I didn't ever get out before it left the theaters. But I think part of, again, it's the, well, it's a remake again.
Yep.
Right now, so far, post-summer, the best movie we've had come out is The Martian.
Yes.
Both in just as a good movie, mm-hmm. but also as box office success.
Yes.
And I think part of that is, oh, thank goodness it wasn't a remake of something or a sequel.
It's an
And it was smart.
It was smart. It was original. It's another case of geeks looking after their own, because it, I mean, the cream rises in a big way with that thing, because he had it out on the net and people started liking it. So he published it. So, and it sold so much that it got real published and turned into a movie. It's great.
It's sort of like the better reflection of 50 Shades of Grey. Cause it was essentially created on a fan forum.
50 Shades of Red. I'm sorry.
It was kind of a fan work, even though it was an original yeah. piece. It was a science geeks fan work mm-hmm. that people went, hey, this is really good. Oh, well, I'm going to publish it. Oh, it succeeded there. And now, multi-million dollar movie starring Matt Damon and Sebastian Stan.
Hey.
You know, and doing great at the box office.
And I have to say, I read at a glacially slow pace. Mm-hmm. And I devoured that book in 2 days, which for me is like a land speed record. My wife took it with us on the vacation that we had when I missed the recording. Mm-hmm. She was able to read all of The Martian and half of a Dresden Files book between Salt Lake City and Sun Valley, Idaho.
Well, you married a very smart woman.
Yes. I married right.
For reference, Daniel's wife's an academic.
Yes. There's also another reason why I like the fact that Emerald City supports Children's Hospital.
So the rest of the studios are just struggling with, but everything's like, the thing is, the audience is becoming a little bit more discerning. And that's because you do have people that are putting out things that we do want to see. And people are becoming a lot less tolerant of, you can't just keep throwing the same crap at us. And studios, because they're so risk adverse, are glacially slow at readjusting to trends. Mm-hmm. I can't think of the studio right now. I want to say it's Universal because I think it usually is, but I'm trying to think who's putting out Crimson Peak. I think it's Universal. As Daniel checks, now Crimson Peak, here's a case of, okay, it's Guillermo del Toro. And that's usually enough to get me in the theater.
Yes.
Guillermo del Toro made a movie. Awesome. Then you add in, hey, it's starring Tom Hiddleston. Good. Guillermo del Toro is doing a gothic romance. Now, here's the thing I'm looking forward to this. And in a couple weeks, the likelihood is Daniel will get another week off because my sister Jill is going to appear on. Because right now, she is in California. She is attending Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios. And she made the trip strictly because they have a Crimson Peak maze. And because it's a gothic romance, her excitement for this movie goes beyond any rational thought.
The squee that is above the range of human hearing.
We cannot hear this, only dolphins. Yeah. Not even dogs, it's just dolphins.
I'm sorry, I love Jilly, and yes, I can hear that.
But one of the things that I have heard, so, because they don't know what else to do, the studio is promoting it as a horror movie. Which is fine. They're releasing in October. That's a great time to do that.
There was an inordinate amount of red in the previews that I saw, so yeah.
But my understanding is that Del Toro went out of his way to make a gothic romance.
Okay.
And a lot of old gothic romances did have supernatural elements. And did have horror elements. But you also had the romance. Now, given when I'm talking gothic romance, we're talking Wuthering Heights. You know, it doesn't end well.
I was going to say, so technically that's what Dracula falls in under as well. So,
but my understanding is from people who have seen early cuts or read the script, he succeeds superbly.
Excellent.
So I'm looking forward to seeing that. I definitely will need to see it before the next episode, because if I haven't seen it by the time I have Jillian on the show, I'll be in trouble and I'll be lost. So.
Here we go. Thank you. Yeah. Produced by Legendary Pictures and distributed by Universal.
Okay, that makes sense. Because I think that's who he's worked with in America mostly. They've described this as Del Toro doing the story of one of his Spanish language films, but in English. And I don't know how much of his Spanish language work you've seen.
Is he the one that did The Devil's Backbone?
Yes.
Yes.
So Devil's Backbone, Pan's Labyrinth, Kronos. He's an excellent horror director. He does these moody pieces amazingly well. And this movie he's counting as kind of a hybrid of his American films, which are large, epic things, and the moody, atmospheric stuff he's done in Mexico.
All right.
And I was, again, they had me at Guillermo del Toro. I hear rumors that of his next movies. He is still talking to Disney about doing his version of The Haunted Mansion.
As opposed to the Eddie Murphy version?
Right.
Okay.
His dream is to do At the Mountains of Madness, but he's trying to do a good version, and the studio keep balking at the budget needs.
I'm sorry, I'm just amused at that. He wants to do this, but a good version.
But another thing that he has talked about is and this ties back into last week, I did not know this until this week. Apparently he wants to do a throwback to the old luchador horror movies.
Okay.
On his TV show, The Strain,
okay,
that he produces, they had a character who used to be a lucha libre, and they actually filmed clips from a movie from that era of that lucha libre versus vampires, because, you know, of course, The Strain is a vampire show. But there is talk that this is sort of him scratching that itch of he really wants to make essentially a Santo movie.
Nice.
But he wants to do it in black and white like the old ones. And
it's an interesting way because, I mean, if he's lifting from something from his past and the culture that he grew up in, it's a way of doing reboots and refreshing looks at stuff without necessarily being the copy of a copy of a copy like Pan.
Right.
Because I was also thinking of the El Mariachi series.
Yeah.
That got redone and redone. And once it got popular, it got redone with a budget.
At least in that case, it got redone by the original creator.
Yeah.
So there's something to be said there. So that's I'm trying to think what else. I'm trying to think if there was anything interesting in comics.
I'll have you know, I've been working my way through Fight Club 2. Okay. With Chuck Palahniuk's graphic novel version of his second of revisiting Fight Club. Good, mind bending, but I mean it's Chuck Palahniuk, so it's opened some doors. I mean I can't talk too much about it without giving a lot of it away. Hi, Pussycat.
And here's Sam. Apparently, Fight Club got his attention.
Yep. Don't meow about Fight Club. That's been amazing. And I actually put in a request at The Dreaming for that Alan Moore that we were talking about, the Dark Knight Master Race.
Oh, you mean the...
Not more.
Not more. Frank Miller.
Frank Miller. That's what
okay,
it was.
Okay, so okay, I want to stop for a second. You're actually going to collect Dark Knight 3?
I am going to get episode 1.
Okay.
I'm going to read it.
Okay.
He even said that... He was nice. He said, you can read this in the store and you can take it back. I'm like, no, I will buy it. I will read it. And I will... If it's horrible, I will use it for kindling. But I am going to get it so we can actually have
the conversation.
The conversation about this. The things I do for this podcast, Jeff, I want you to know.
Your commitment to Sparkle Motion.
Yes. No one doubts.
Yeah. Okay. Sam is even impressed.
Yep.
So, that's... I think the only other thing I want to touch on briefly is with it being mid-October, all the TV shows are back.
Okay.
And that means that all of the CW DC Comics-based shows have
Gotham
returned.
And all that.
Gotham is actually Fox.
See, I don't have television, so I don't know these things.
And it's been back for a while. All I can say is, you know, I've always described Gotham as a mix of great and terrible. They've toned down on the terrible.
Okay.
The terrible's not gone, but they've trimmed back on it.
Okay.
And the elements that are really good are still really good. What they need is to find an excuse to have just one scene that has Donald Loge, Sean Pertwee, and Robin Lord Taylor all in it together so they can have the best parts of the show all in one scene. Because Harvey Bullock, the Penguin, and Alfred are still hands down the best things on that show.
Nail down the scenery because it's going to get gnawed on.
But, oh, yeah. Quite a bit. And but yeah, they've one thing they did that I think helped the show is they've abandoned the police procedural aspect. It's not a case of a week thing anymore.
Hmm.
Even the police work aspects are part of an ongoing story.
Okay.
It's still, I mean, any prequel to me, unless they do something like Hannibal did, where they just say, and we don't care.
Yeah.
you know, we're going to go into places. It's not going to end the same place you expect because we're doing our own thing. Then any prequel, there's always those handcuffs. With that said, so season 4 of Arrow finally got to a point I had been waiting for since episode 1. Because my question from the beginning is, why isn't he the Green Arrow? And the answer is, he had to get there. That they started him in a dark place, and to him to be the Green Arrow, he had to come out of the darkness into the light.
Okay.
So he went from the Hood, from the Vigilante to the Hood to the Arrow to now the Green Arrow.
Okay.
And it's like with that progression, you know what? I'm going to let him have it.
Cool.
Show's still good. They're exploring some interesting themes because with the companion series, The Flash, you know, season 1 of Arrow might as well have been Batman Begins, the Green Arrow version, because it was very grounded. Now it's very much in a comic book universe.
Cool.
Superpowers are a thing. He's got trick arrows, but they work their way towards it.
Okay.
And then The Flash has always been just a comic book show from the get-go. The thing they did, I am so glad my wife is on the road right now. Because they've introduced the multiverse, which was the big thing in The Flash in the late 60s. Or actually, I don't think it was the late 60s, but they introduced the Earth 2, the universe that had the Golden Age heroes on it, and with the famous story of The Flash of Two Worlds. So episode 2 was called The Flash of Two Worlds.
Dum, dum, dum.
And they brought Jay Garrick, the Earth 2 Flash, into the show. And at the end of the episode, in the show, they literally recreated the cover of that issue.
So they did a Sin City where it's just like you can hold up the image and a still from the
just about.
Nice.
I mean, it's not exact, but to the point of on the cover the dialogue was coming, or I'm coming, and somebody yelled Flash and they both went coming. And then and there was a brick wall separating them. And you see them run on the other side of this brick wall.
Nice.
And the person who they're running to is in the exact same pose as the person on the cover. It was just one of those, I geeked out.
Nice.
I just completely geeked out. But you know, it's doing good work. And then iZombie, getting kind of back to our Halloween theme, also premiered. And it's been a great show. Now, it deviates from the comics probably more than any of these. But it's a lesser-known comic. My only problem with iZombie is the problem I have with a lot of shows. And that is, when they adapt something, they suddenly turn it into a police procedural.
Well,
now, in iZombie, I'm more forgiving because the premise of iZombie is a woman gets turned into a zombie. And to maintain her intelligence and humanity, she has to eat brains. And when she eats a brain, she gets the memories of the brain she ate. In the comic, she then has a compulsion usually to finish up any business that person had. In the TV show, she uses that information to solve the person's murder.
Interesting. Okay.
And I forget what her career was in the comic, but in the TV show, she goes to work for the morgue because she was a med student. so that she has access to brains without having to do anything horrible. And her supervisor quickly figures out what's going on and helps her. That kind of thing. But the thing that iZombie really has going for it, and the first season's on Netflix, so you can watch it. It's created by Rob Thomas, who created Veronica Mars.
Okay.
And it has much the same vibe, and that's, for a lot of people, that's a positive.
Okay.
It's set in Seattle, as many shows filmed in Vancouver are.
How about that?
So, yeah, that's, in comics themselves, other than, you know, we've got the Dark Knight 2 coming out, and, Secret Wars has, or Dark Knight 3, sorry, Secret Wars is wrapping up, and they're doing the relaunch of the Marvel Universe.
Again?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, this is weird, because Marvel Universe, they always prided themselves on never doing a full reboot of the universe. They would certainly have retcons, but they were trying to do the more subtle retcons. And they had the sliding timeline, you know, it was all, things were always 20 years ago.
They have turned it off and turned it back on enough. They can call it a retcon, they can call it a reboot, I don't care.
But this is the closest Marvel's ever had to a full DC-style retcon.
Okay.
And the only thing that I think is funny, and they've even admitted this, so Spider-Man, that's what I want to talk about this week in comics. Spider-Man. So you actually have two Spider-Man, because what they've done is they've merged the characters from the Ultimate Universe that survived into the Prime Marvel Universe, which means you have Miles Morales, the Ultimate Spider-Man, running around in New York City, but you still have Peter Parker. But building off of storylines that have been going on since Superior Spider-Man, Peter Parker found himself owning a company.
Okay.
Quick story. The Superior Spider-Man storyline was Dr. Octopus took over Spider-Man's body.
Yeah.
And while he was, for about the year and a half, he was running around as Peter Parker, finished Peter's doctorate. Because, damn it, he was going to be a doctor again. So finished Peter's doctorate and started up a company. Because, you know, why not? And when Peter got his body back, he suddenly found, okay, A, I'm now Dr. Peter Parker, and I have a company, and I have a lot of employees. And of course, part of the storyline was he didn't know what he was doing. So the new series has an 8-month time jump, as every other series does. And apparently in those 8 months, he got his act together. And the company became very successful. And Peter's made a lot of money. And Parker Industries has major offices in New York and London and Shanghai. And Peter has to go to all of them. And Spider-Man is, in fact, the corporate logo. Because Spider-Man is working as Peter Parker's bodyguard and mascot for the company.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
And they even admit he is literally doing what Tony Stark did with Iron Man in the original run. But in comics, he admits to people, it worked for Stark for a long time, so I'm going to do it. Which, you know, as long as they're going to, like, at least acknowledge that stuff,
yes,
I'm fine with it.
Hang a lampshade on it, be done.
Yeah. I'm hearing the story is fun. Of course, I read all of my Marvel comics on Marvel Unlimited, so I won't get to see this series for 6 months.
So there's an 8-month lag and a 6-month lag. And
Yeah. Somewhere I'll catch up in the middle.
Okay.
So I think, anything else?
The only other thing I was going to ask, same thing I asked from before. What are you reading this week?
So because I've been busy with, some writing, I've been kind of bouncing back and forth in my reading. I've actually been doing a lot of catch up on Marvel Comics. I actually decided, because I didn't read it, I'm actually reading Superior Spider-Man.
Okay.
Just because I want to kind of see what built into the series. Along with, I'm still reading Shepherd's Crown by Terry Pratchett, which I realize there's a part of me, I'm slogging through Shepherd's Crown, not that it's a hard read, but there's a lot of emotion involved because it's the last Pratchett.
I was going to say, because once you've done...
That's it. There'll be no more Pratchett.
There's no more new Pratchett.
So I just can kind of going through that slowly. And I'm not 100% sure what my next... I'm kind of leaning towards going back to Gail Carriger's Finishing School series, which is a steampunk supernatural series, but she's a great author. And or I might actually pull a note from you and read The Martian.
It's well worth it. I was able to get it from the library, turned around quick, and like I say, I devoured it, and I read remarkably slow. For me, like I say, I made it through Martian, and also, as I mentioned before, did Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice, which is the first in her trilogy. It's the one that won the Hugo and the Arthur C. Clarke, and I think a Nebula, all in the same year. There's a lot of good press for it. I struggled with it. A lot of people say it's because of the pronouns. I didn't have a problem with the pronouns.
The
Reader's Digest condensed version is that the main character is the embodiment of what used to be a ship's worth of an AI.
Okay.
And this ship's worth of an AI has seen like 3,000 years worth of human history. And as we know, what counts as a guy and what counts as a woman has evolved in the last 2,000 years. And the same thing is done with that in that ship's 3,000 years. And so the ship has a hard time telling what's a man and what's a woman. So the ship refers to everyone as a woman.
Oh, interesting.
Because, you know, you think about it. Men are the ones that started wearing wigs. Men are the ones that started wearing high heels. Men are the ones that started wearing makeup. And that's just been in the last 500 years.
True.
So, but like I say, some people have a problem with the pronouns. I just imagine that 95% of the people in the book were women, and it was fine. My problem was with the unreliability of the narrator.
Okay.
And there's an idea of what counts as who you are and your memories that make you.
All right.
But it's still a good show. It's still a good book. I still enjoyed it. It just, there was a sticky part in the middle, and I had to push through. Thanks to Genevieve for encouraging, and Ro too, for encouraging me to push through.
Okay.
Just finished that, and the next book on the to-be-read list is Three Body Problem, which is this year's Hugo Award winner.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Cool. So I do have one last thing I want to talk about real fast before, and it involves books.
Okay.
Before we wrap up. And it should still be going on when the episode goes live. Jillian, my sister, who will most likely be on next episode, is involved in a Kickstarter.
Okay.
She's kickstarting a book, and just search on Fairy Tales. You should be able to find it. She and her friend, Thea Maia, have done a set of coloring books. It's two books that one is for adults and one is for kids. And the idea is you have the same fairy tale and the same basic picture, but one has a complexity level for adults to color and one has a complexity level for kids to color, so parents and their children can color together.
Interesting.
And Thea did the art and Jill's writing the text, and Jill's also doing the complexity of the text based on age range. So the interpretation of the fairy tale will have a complex, more adult spin in the adult version and be more childlike for the child version.
Interesting.
I think this is a fascinating idea, and they are very close to funding.
Good.
So, you know, just that push wherever you can, and might as well do this. And with that, thank you very much for listening, as always, everyone. If you want to drop Daniel and I a line, we can be contacted by visiting www.fanboynewsnetwork.com and leaving us a note in the comment section. Until then, we will talk to you later.
Thanks, y'all. Have a good one.
This program is produced by Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network and is copyright 2015 to Jeff Harris and Fanboy News Network. All rights are reserved, including rights to copy and redistribute this program. All music in this podcast comes from The Footage Firm and is used under a royalty-free license.